Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with Stephen Riley, the director of the brand new documentary Listen to Me, Marlon, about the life and career of Marlon Brando. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Nice to speak to you guys.
So what was your personal connection to making the movie? Were you a huge Brando fan or what? What was the tie?
No, in fact, I mean, I'd seen his films and was, knew him as a great actor and, impressed by all the top roles like Godfather, Last Tango, It's Now. But I didn't know too much about him at all. The way I got involved was actually the production company, who I've worked with a few times before, called me up and said, what are you up to? Would you be interested in doing a film on Marlon Brando? So it was a very open brief at that point because the access was in place. The Brando family and the Brando estate were happy that a film would take place, the right approach and the right director. And then it was up to me to kind of just really figure out what was the way into this man's life. And to really understand him, and there was a lot for me to get my head around because the further I got in, the more complex and contradictory he revealed himself to be. It was a fascinating journey. It was a great research process, and I was fortunate to have the chance to make it.
Now, you kind of right there, you just mentioned kind of two different things here. First was the access to all this unseen and unheard archive of footage from his family. And then the other part was how you then, deciphered all of that and found your little angle at it. Let's talk about the first part, the your access. How did you get the ability to access all this archive here?
Well, it just so happened that the Brando estate were sort of figuring out their entire act, really. I mean, I suppose there have been 10 years since Marlon had passed away, and a lot of the boxes and his personal effects and archive had just been in storage that entire time. So coincidentally, as the possibility of the film came around, all of these being unpacked, and everything from that remained of Marlon's personal effects, and that includes documentation and things of furniture, ornaments, and also these tapes, audio and visual, were just coming out and coming to the surface. So that was one of the first questions that I asked: what do we have access to? And I was included these tapes, and I listened to a first handful, in the course of doing my first month's research and trying to figure out an approach, I just started questioning, how interesting it would be if the story was told entirely in Marlon's own words, because he had been so private and hadn't given those interviews during the course of his life. That would be an amazing attempt at an approach to the film. But I just didn't know that was at all possible right then, because there ended up being about close to 300 hours of audio tapes that came out of the boxes eventually, but wasn't obvious straight away. But thankfully it all worked out, and the materials ended up being there, and with a lot of hard work, Marlon is the only voice in the film, and he could tell his entire life story,
So you wanted it to be something where it's not outside talking heads. It's basically Brando on Brando. That was kind of the concept.
Yeah, exactly. And it was an exciting prospect initially to not go that talking head route.
Sure. Yeah.
And it was just great to be able to fulfill that. I mean, I ended up doing, going about the film in a regular way as far as I approach stuff. That I read all the books. I went out to the States and met all of his family and friends and work colleagues who I could possibly get into, who would sit down with me and I could talk about him really try and get to the essence of him. That was really incredibly useful eventually. Having those notes, and I just took them as notes on my phone, and because it allowed me to penetrate the material in a meaningful and understand and with a degree more understanding than I would have had otherwise.
Awesome. Yeah. Now, obviously, I haven't seen the movie yet. Because it opens next month, August 14th. I'd love to check it out before this piece actually airs. But I'm really interested in how you went about structuring the doc, balancing stuff about his personal life and his professional life. Like, do you intersperse film clips at all, or is it mostly just his personal life?
There's a mix of stuff, really. I mean, in terms of the spaces in the film. I mean, narratively. There's three ages of Brando, which are all very much interdependent because so much of his later experience and the things which happened in his life and his character was dictated, as for all of us, by our early years. So there's the tale of Brando the young boy, Brando the actor, and then also Brando the old man living in Mulholland in a fairly reclusive mode that we're familiar with. So that was something which was already part of the original conception, as was the idea of the film being a self psychoanalysis. Where Brando was trying to figure out all of the whys and wherefores of his own character. And specifically as well, how the tragedy which happened in his house in Mulholland, which a lot of people know about, where his daughter's boyfriend was shot by his son, and his son had shot his sister's boyfriend, in the family house. In the film, is almost a decomposition of how that event could have ever have come to pass. For somebody who was so thought out and philosophical, and as Marlon was, and someone who was just trying to keep her figure out the problems of ourselves and our character, how could this terrible thing have happened in his own home?
Right.
That's part of the narrative too, an investigation into that.
Do you save that until the third chapter, third act, or do you kind of introduce it early, Sunset Boulevard style, and then come back around to how it came to be, kind of a thing?
You see it early on, and then there's echoes of it exactly in that way. It's somewhat of a Freudian study too, because in order to understand how that happened, you have to go back to Marlon's childhood.
Love it.
As well, to see it's a generational tale as well.
Let's kind of move through those three chapters one by one. So, because now you just brought up Marlon's childhood, what are some of those Freudian things in that first act of this of his life that you think that led to some of these things later in life that you just referred to?
He had a very turbulent childhood, without a doubt. I mean, his mum and his dad were both drinkers. She was an alcoholic, and his dad was, it was violent towards his mother and violent towards him as well sometimes. So, for somebody as sensitive as Marlon, he's had massive repercussions. And he says, fairly tellingly, that he thinks that we spend our entire lives trying to overcome the problems and bad habits established in the first 10 years of our life.
Totally.
So a lot of that is, those repercussions are felt through the film.
That's the whole Rosebud argument, man. I mean, that's it, man. It's what happens when you're young. I mean, that's on your deathbed, you're still thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, and actually, and almost like your past is inescapable.
Yeah, that's true.
Of it, which you have no control over, and only with the hardest work can you ever seek to overturn that kind of the effects of that.
So it's kind of fatal experiences. Kind of fatalistic in that sense, like it's already destined.
Yeah, well, I think this is one of the questions he really analyzed, and certainly in the course of his life in the film as well. But I know that was a big question. How much power do we really have? He was getting involved in, as he's heard in the tapes in the film, in self-hypnosis and self-therapy, And you know, he was really trying to, you know, correct those wrongs and to, in some way, parent himself and give himself the parenting which he felt he never had.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty heavy stuff. Let's move into the professional part of his career. What does he have to say about kind of sort of his, you know, his big break and leap from Broadway to Hollywood?
Well, he just, I mean, everyone sort of says, oh, you know, Brando should have done more stage acting and what a waste and, you know, and, you know, God, he threw his talent away. But yeah, you discover actually the trials and the difficulties that an actor like Brando, who pioneered the method, who was bringing so much of his own life into his parts, it was tough work. It was just too hard for him to play Stanley Kowalski every night, who was a violent drunk,
and
which is obviously a character who was quite familiar to him. But you know, when he was in Streetcar, broke all records at that point and was a massive runaway Broadway success. But after 2 years in that, I think it broke him down, and he the last thing he ever wanted to do was get involved in theatre. But he was, and I'm convinced he was an artist. He really wanted to excel in his craft, and as much as he would disparage acting and became very disillusioned, deeply disillusioned at many points, you know, when he had the fire in his belly, he really wanted to do great things, and I think he understood that he could reform cinema, and he wasn't impressed by the previous generation of actors, mm-hmm. Who he felt were far too stilted and overly dramatic and.
Right.
You know, with just stiff in their role play, and he wanted to bring in a much more manneristic and naturalistic and truthful form of acting, and that's the revolution with which he's credited, because his early roles, including in The Man and Viva Zapata and Streetcar Named Desire, mm-hmm. were revolutionary in film, and he achieved what he wanted to set out to do in movie making, and nothing's been the same since.
Yeah, I mean, you just mentioned about how he thought, you know, he wasn't impressed with the previous generation, and then here in Streetcar, you know, he's working for Kazan, so he knows this, you know, familiar, you know, face that helped him pioneer what he was doing in theater, and then he gets to Hollywood, and he's working right across the screen from Vivian Leigh, who's the total different acting style. She is that very traditional style that you said he didn't really respect, and here he was this new method force on the scene. So what does he have to say about, you know, in the documentary, does he have anything to say about what it was like, you know, those two clashing styles in Streetcar?
He didn't speak about Vivian Leigh specifically. I mean, you mentioned the pair of them. I mean, when I watched, and I hadn't seen Streetcar, which goes to show, you know, I had a lot of research too. I hadn't seen Streetcar before I started researching the movie. The documentary. I saw that scene, the opening scene where Blanche meets Stanley.
Yeah.
And that right there just explains everything. You can just see in just the way he carries himself versus, you know, the doyen of the old school, Vivian Leigh. You know, what the revolution would be. But no, in terms of talking specifically about Vivian in that moment, he doesn't. But he certainly has a lot to say about characters like Clark Gable and Humphrey Bogart. Mm. Who he thought were formulaic, and he said that they were playing themselves. He said that they weren't actually character actors in a way. And actually, that was the one revealing thing to me in terms of finishing, you know, the research and the move of the film, was that he, you know, there's been no one like Brando, and I think, you know, obviously he's put on his own pedestal, but he never played, he would got too bored playing himself.
Right.
And when you see that he obviously got an Oscar for playing an Italian-American in The Godfather, mm-hmm. He also got an Oscar playing a Mexican in Viva Zapata, he played an Englishman, and by the way, he's taking on the accents for all these characters as well. He's not just, you know, coming in with his own voice and a different costume. He's actually trying to really play cross-cultural roles and to try and really understand the tics and habits and mannerisms of an entire culture. That's where he studied, and I really can't name, even to this day, many actors who were nearly as brave as him you know, and you know, he played a German, he played a Chinaman, he played the gamut of roles which he attempted was quite extraordinary, and not since repeated, I don't think.
Absolutely, and there's so many great ones, and you know, I want to be able to just touch briefly on them because I know our listeners, that's the meat of this, that they're going to want to hear. Like, oh, what did he have to say about On the Waterfront and Godfather, you know? So, but if let's have fun with it. Is there a way we can kind of move through them just sort of quickly? I'll mention one of the roles and you can give me something, maybe an interesting tidbit from the doc that he had to say about it. We mentioned Streetcar. How about On the Waterfront? What cool insight about that? I mean, that to me, that might be his career role. I mean, well, other than Godfather.
Well, what's fascinating, you know, by the way, sorry, on that earlier thing, can you correct me? He didn't get an Oscar for Viva Zapata. He got an Oscar nomination.
Right.
Obviously, but he got the an Oscar for...
He won for On the Waterfront,
But what was fascinating about On the Waterfront was that he was so despondent and depressed on watching the film.
Really?
And he thought that it wasn't... Yeah, he was not impressed at all with his acting and thought that he could have done a much better job, and then was actually very surprised when the film won an Oscar. And then he goes into this deep inquiry into, you know, well, actually, well, then how did that come to pass? How can I think it was so bad? And yet the audience loved it. And then he starts exploring the idea of mythology and the power of myth. And he had this... you know, idea that developed that the actor shouldn't get in the way of the story, you know, and that the audience who is acting, the audience feels they could have been a contender. The audience feels inferiority. Mm-hmm. Everyone's had that moment. So
yeah.
Or he just felt that he was a conduit for that rather than responsible for it.
That's so wild to me that, you know, because we all look back at it, how many, it was 1954, so decades later, and we view it as one of the great, you know, movie performances ever, but it's just wild to me that he could walk off set and think he failed at it. Even giving the famous speech, it could have been a contender, it was you, Charlie, he wasn't even pleased with that?
Well, there was, I think he was pleased with the eventual outcome of that, because in the end, Kazan had chosen his version of it, because they were going to go about it a few different ways. And one thing for that particular scene, which I think it's been written about, and, you know, it's almost, it's one of those anecdotes and things that have been retold, but certainly when Brando describes it, yes, it was a bit of an ad hoc improvised taxi cab in the back of a lot that was a pickup shop, effectively.
They threw the Venetian blinds in the back.
they put a curtain over the back. They couldn't do a rear projection, and then they set about, you know, just trying to figure the scene out in a very short amount of time. And I think the original script had it that he was going to be, you know, threatened with the gun, Brando was going to react, I forget whether in an intimidated or an angry way, but actually it was Brando who said that, you know, he would have just been disappointed
that
his brother could have sunk to that level, and that was his improvisation on that, and so he just gently, the emotion of that scene when Brando set that up.
It's such a better reaction too, and he gives that look. He's like, really, really, my brother Charlie, you're really gonna do this? It was you, Charlie. I mean that, but that's Brando. He's bringing the whole tone to that scene. You're saying,
well, that absolutely. And I think what's more reflective in Brando's disappointment, in his own disappointment, he watches the film and thinks, you know, God, that could have been better. It says a lot about Brando's own perfectionism.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
He really did care, and he knew a good performance. He could have done better, and he was always striving for that. And that's not something which he would, you know, often want other people to know about necessarily, because that was another point of vulnerability.
Right.
You know, he did care about that stuff. And he always, and even in the roles which we wouldn't have really considered, I think he often went into them with good intentions. Sometimes needing the money, but when he committed to something, I think he always wanted to give it his best shot, even when it would hold, and, you know, on some occasions, fire. But I think when you're as brave an actor as him, and you're trying such different things as he was, that he would attempt, then you'd miss.
Absolutely. Well, Waterfront, one of the great movies of all time. But and then the very next year, basically to your point about how he took on such a broad range of roles, the very following year he does Guys and Dolls and he's doing a musical. I mean, with Sinatra and Gene Simmons and the rest. What was it like for him to rev up for that kind of a role? That's a totally new challenge compared to the previous film roles he had.
I think that role for him, and that was his first really big Hollywood movie. Of course, he's already won an Oscar at this point, but that was the one with that was a big budget movie,
right?
And it was a new experience for him. But I think in another respect, it was a respite because he'd had a lot of very heavy roles. His first five mm-hmm. films were pretty intense, and
right.
the subject matter was quite heavy. So the chance to something that was light and to stretch his range as an actor. And again, he was thinking about, he always dismissed that acting was something that he got into accidentally, and there was a degree of accident, but there was a lot of design there. And he was already starting to think about the breadth of his roles and his range. I think he and comedy was something that he hadn't done,
right?
So he threw himself into it, but it was a bit of a poison chalice because it was after that that his fame really exploded.
Yeah.
And, obviously he was popular at that point, but then he became like it just hit a much bigger audience, that size of movie, than his other stuff did. And, and fame was the one thing that would really catch up with him by the end of his, and torment him, I think, in his later years.
Absolutely. Does he talk at all about, just moving chronologically a little bit, does he talk about One-Eyed Jacks, his directorial effort? I think the one and only, right?
He did, yeah. I mean, he did actually. I mean, there are clips of One-Eyed Jacks in the film. And,
okay.
And as it happened, I was keen to find a way to actually look into that, or at least, but the visuals are there. But, I mean, it's one of my favorites, actually. And I know there are some of his films that, I discovered when directing The Doc, and that was one of them. And I think it's a great, fantastic Western. He directed it, showed a lot of skill in that. There's some famous about how the edit was taken away from him and that upset him greatly. But even with that, and even with it not being the cut I think he was most keen on, there's no denying how good a film it was.
Is that why he never returned to it? But because he didn't get final, carte blanche at the end?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was there was just pressure for him to be out of the edit room.
Yeah.
He was wrestling with it. He'd gone over it, and he'd spent the cut was still quite long when he was whittle it down, but people ran out of patience. And the studio took it away from him, and that was soul destroying for him because he'd actually put in a hell of a lot of work into it. But despite that, it's still a great film. I think Scorsese's favorite Western as well, actually.
Wow.
Scorsese.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's. I always found it a curious case with a guy like Brando and One-Eyed Jacks, or Charles Laughton with Night of the Hunter. It's like, how do these super huge actors, and they try to go behind the camera, and it's a one-off, and they decide this isn't for me. But decades later, we look at both of them as freaking masterpieces. So that's just fascinating to me.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, his skills in directing and writing are just much undersold.
Mm-hmm.
You got. Much more than an actor with Brando, and it's touched in the film, certainly with the looking at scripts of Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
But he would just rewrite stuff. He'd have it in his contract where he could have the ability to change his lines, and because he would improvise so much, and it was always a studied improvisation.
Sure.
I would not be at all surprised if he had a lot of those thoughts and ideas in his mind before he even arrived on set.
Right.
But he would craft things and deliver interpretations on characters and change the script in much more interesting ways than the writers had originally put down. And so that was a feature of many of his films, including The Godfather.
Mm.
He changed the script a lot. When you get the original script and you watch that film,
yeah.
you see how many lines that Marlon's changed himself and how much value he's added. And
let's talk
and
about
even, you know, the famous. Oh, beg your pardon. I was only going to say the one thing about directing. You know, in the Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Was that he? Which I found fascinating, and it was that the entire lighting of that was at Marlon's request.
You mean the final horror scene in the compound?
Yeah, well, most of that stuff, you know, that indoor material where there's shafts of light and right. Marlon moves between the light and the darkness,
like half lit faces and stuff. Yeah,
of Kurt's. Yeah, that was all coming from him, and that's his instincts, you know, coming through there.
That's great. I want to get to Apocalypse in a second, but you mentioned The Godfather. Clearly, I mean, the role that most people of all generations are, you know, will remember him for. Did he have any similar reservations as you said he did with Waterfront in terms of, you know, he thought he stunk up the joint and wound up winning an Oscar? I mean, he wound up winning for The Godfather, but did he know this was going to be huge?
At that point, you know, there's no doubt that he actually was pretty. You know, he was in need of the role, mm-hmm. and you know, he was in need of money. He had lots of dependents from different relationships, and you know, children, and had an archipelago in the South Pacific to pay for. You know, and he needed work, and actually, and a lot of the phone calls, the phone had stopped ringing, and a lot of the work had dried up because. You know, a series of films in the 60s that hadn't really done at all well.
Right.
So there was a degree of urgency to actually, you know, to get a role and to do something good just to pay the bills. So, but you know, he talks about him an insecurity that he had, that he didn't know whether he was going to be right for that part and whether he could play it.
Yeah.
And he had to find that role and really weigh in. Yeah. And I just thought it was really interesting that, you know, as he would often do, he'd bring to best, you know, readings and thoughts and ideas that he was interested in, you know, that he was reading into outside of film. And one was the nature of good and evil. In fact, this was something which occupied him for, you know, I think other roles as well. But I think it reached its apogee in The Godfather, where he just was analyzing, you know, the nature of the hero. And he thought, you know, how fascinating it would be to tell the story of a gangster, not that he was a bad man, but that he was very gentle.
Yeah.
And just trying to get us to question our own ideas about, you know, what is good and bad, what is evil, you know, what right do we have to judge people too quickly? And that was, you know, one of his ways in, and he, you know, did see it as a capitalist tale. And it's, obviously the film's quite different to the book. And does, you know, go in different directions, including Marlon's character, and again he was responsible for that.
Yeah, and you mentioned that he in his own life, his personal life, was very aware and grappled with the concept of this fatalistic idea of how much, you know, power we actually have over our own life, or are we kind of destined to this doomed, you know, ending that's already been written before we even were born. I feel like this is all over The Godfather. I mean, this is Michael Corleone, the one son that he doesn't want to go into the family gangster life. Why, you know, no matter what Vito does, Michael, it's almost like fate, it's in the stars that he's destined to come back around and become exactly like him, except way more evil, especially in part two. Do you think he saw parallels between that sort of fatalism in Coppola's vision versus his own life?
It's interesting. You know, in terms of specifics, I can't think of any, but, you know, it certainly wouldn't surprise me, you know, on that. I mean, I think he was somebody who was, you know, despite the fact that he had, you know, a troubled upbringing of his own, he had a, you know, deep family and a deep aspiration to be within, you know, a functioning family that was, you know, clearly a departure from what he'd grown up with.
Yeah.
So I think he'd have had a, you know, he certainly felt a deep sense of obligation and tie and the gravity of the family and the fate that might then include, you know, that, yeah, you're almost at the mercy of the fates when you're dealing with things like issues like you're dealing with obligations of duty, you know, to your family.
Yeah. So when he says lines like "a man that doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man," it rings very personal to him, huh?
Well, that's it. And you know, and to be honest, I mean, again, to find out whether Marlon had come up with that line himself, but it'd be interesting to, you know, to look into that, you know, because that's the kind of stuff he would do.
Yeah.
Again, if you look at the script of The Godfather, there were definite changes that, you know, came with it.
Was that one of them? You said he came up with that line?
Oh no, I don't know.
Oh,
but
okay.
Again, you know, I wouldn't be surprised.
I get
you know, it'd be interesting to find out. I mean, I wouldn't, for any film historian, they probably want to check on that. But right. There's a lot of changes that Marlon was bringing on classic scripts, even like The Godfather.
Did he explain his infamous Sachin Littlefeather Oscar acceptance speech, where he didn't show up and sent, you know, the Native American to accept it, who wasn't really a Native American, right? What was that whole controversy? Did he talk about that in the movie?
He does. He talks about yes, that definitely features, because I mean, the cause of the Native American Indian was so it was so dominant in Marlon's life, and mm-hmm. And a cause which he was faithful to. For,
why do you think that was?
Decades. I think he really was wrestling with questions of his own conscience, mm-hmm. from an early age.
Right.
I think he really he asked, you know, how am I my brother's keeper?
Right.
And he felt that he should, you know, that it was his job as in the course of his life to find truth, and also to do the right thing. And he, very early on, from a young age, he was always on the side of the light. And I find it fascinating, his journey in his life, where he actually ends up becoming, you know, from being so idealistic, you know, not just in his acting, he really wanted to find truth, but he also wanted to find truth to humanity and find mm-hmm. a better way and mode for us all to live together in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And by over the years, it slipped, you know, that idealism, and ended up becoming something a bit more nihilistic. Coincidentally, around the time of Apocalypse Now, where you know, he felt that actually we were doomed in a sense, because our own essential nature was animalistic, and we were doomed to hurt each other. And it infected his acting as well. He felt that, you know, that truth was a far-flung pursuit, and that, you know, life is a lie, as well, and acting is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of idealism early doors. I mean, in his life, I think he really wanted to make sure that he helped other people, and he did actually stick faithfully to the cause of the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone who was oppressed, anyone who was in any way put upon and downtrodden, he felt an immediate sympathy for, because that's how he felt when he was a kid.
Yeah,
you know, when he felt like he was the outsider, his family were the sort of persona non grata in town, because his mum was you know, somewhat notorious for her, you know, being the town drunk, and he felt as if he really fit in, and had an empathy for others who didn't as well,
mm-hmm.
And that's the American Indian cause, and felt that the American society had to address that hypocrisy.
Yeah,
American, you know, the American ideal of being, you know, virtuous and freedom seeking,
a melting pot and all that. The ideals are there, but we haven't always lived up to it, is what he's saying.
Pretty much, exactly. And that was you know, and he wanted to just make sure that we were aware of that, and the Americans rather addressed it, and would give the, you know, rightful apology and compensation to American Native American Indians, many of whom were his friends.
Absolutely. And I think those hypocrisies and corruptions from all levels are just woven so beautifully into the Godfather movies. I mean, I think that's why they're arguably the greatest ever done. But did he explain why he didn't come back for part two? Because they had to, you know, redo the whole ending there so that he wasn't on screen, you know, when they have the flashback.
No, it's not. It's not in the documentary, I think it might have been for money matters.
Oh, okay.
You know, he didn't get paid a lot at all for Godfather, and actually sold his stake in it nothing. He got an upfront payment to actually cash in any equity in the film. Mm. So he didn't really make much from Godfather 1 at all. So when he wanted he was seeking some compensation for that in Godfather 2, I don't think they were ready to stamp up that.
Yeah, it's such a shame too, because there's in so many ways Part 2, you know, expands upon and is just almost is an equally if not better film too. And it's so beautiful to see, you know, Pacino intercut with De Niro playing the younger Brando. But man, if they could have also had Brando in there, it seems such a shame if they couldn't have almost done the three-way parallel story. That would have been insane. But be that as it may, beggars can't be choosers. They're amazing flicks. What was his thoughts on Coppola? Between The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. What were his thoughts as a filmmaker? I mean, to me, the guy was a visionary genius.
I think there were a few directors that he very much respected. Certainly Kazan, Gio Pontecorvo. He had a lot of respect for even when they did a film called Burn. And that's one of his. That was his favorite film, in fact, Burn. And also. Bertolucci, I think he had a lot of respect for, and then Coppola. I think those four directors, among all of them, were the ones that Brando felt most affinity towards. And but he was not impressed with Coppola's behaviour, certainly around the time of Apocalypse Now, because there was that article in Life magazine. Where Coppola had talked in disparaging terms about Brando's commitment to the role, that he was time wasting, that he arrived on set and he was overweight, and they really didn't appreciate being upset by that, because he felt that he'd saved Coppola in the course of making that film, because the script wasn't fully formed, and it was on the basis of it was rewritten by Brando. And I was listening to the tapes that Brando recorded, which included all the preparations for the character of Kurtz, and again very different from the original script.
Yeah.
And Brando was bringing in a lot of the stuff that he was interested in, and should definitely be given a lot of credit for reforming that last act.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he felt there was a minor betrayal, if not major betrayal, by Coppola in not recognizing that.
So was all that stuff true then? That I've always heard those stories, and there was the great documentary about it, Hearts of Darkness, Filmmaker's Apocalypse, I think it was called. That was shot by Coppola's wife. But was it true about, how he showed up? He hadn't even read the Conrad book. I think I heard somewhere that he was overweight. I mean, was any of that true? But also, he also thought that Coppola, should have overlooked that, because he did, and in the end, save his movie, save his Act 3.
Well, there was all sorts of things going on around that. There were money issues again. Brando wanted to get his agreed payment up front. Coppola wasn't in the position to pay it. There had been a lot of Brando was been leaning on Coppola for that payment. So that was a separate issue that was affecting things. Even when you watch Hearts of Darkness, there's a bit of an anomaly in there. When, because Coppola admits that it was a complete Nuthouse.
Oh yeah.
And the entire production had hit the rocks, and he didn't have a script, and and he says, well, what do you do in that situation? Do you go away and spend months writing a script, or do you do improvisations with Marlon Brando? He even said that in the film. So the fact that that it went over by a couple of weeks and Brando's rewriting it for him, I think it just seems a bit hypocritical that you can't, have your cake and eat it and say that, I want to do improvisations. They take a bit longer. And, difficult. There's no question. I think he would, if he didn't like a director or if he lost faith in the production, he could play up. He could be tough. But it was always, it was often for a point of, not always from a point of petulance. It was because he actually cared and felt in there.
Yeah.
And he felt that, things were going to go, that weren't going according to, the high hopes that he really would have originally have had. In this instance, I just think that I just, on balance, I love Coppola. I love his, is my hero in terms of the films that he's done. But on this topic of Brando and Coppola and their relationship and Apocalypse Now, I think there's more to be said on that.
Interesting.
And I think Brando deserved his comeback, which he gets in the film, and he talks about it.
That's very, very fascinating. I mean, like you, I've always admired Coppola's work, big time, right up there with any other filmmaker. But this, you always hear the stories about Brando being unprepared on Apocalypse Now. But it's nice to hear sort of the other side in his own words of, hey, buddy, I was rewriting everything. Was the horror was that his improv line, or was that actually in the original script? Do you know?
So that particular, I don't know. All I can tell you is that that there were tapes where Brando is just ad-libbing into a dictaphone, and is just exploring the logic of deep evil.
kind of like Kurtz in the movie.
Exactly, because the original character of Kurtz, when you see it, was almost like a reprobate.
Yeah,
and he was very decadent. He had concubines and was, and sort of a very different person. He wasn't this embodiment of evil or the heart of darkness, which was Brando's innovation. I mean, obviously he would have discussed it with Coppola, but then goes away and does these lines.
Yeah,
all the stuff that he was fascinated by. He was saying, how could you actually make this guy intelligent? How could you make Kit Kurtz a smart person who, in some respects, could justify these terrible acts? And that was the challenge, and that's the stuff he was exploring. But that's all by himself, and he's doing these improvs, and then that's really what was kind of and you can see on the making of Hearts and Darkness, that's what Brando's doing. He just keep doing this stuff until he dried up. He just riff until what was cut.
Wow. Yeah. I think that ultimately that's why the film works almost in its transcendent we're all screwed kind of way. But it's following his mental journey as Kurtz Brando in the role as Kurtz going further down the metaphorical river. I kind of hear you. I think Brando's wrestling with his own demons there in a weird way sort of saved what was a hellacious shoot. And they're both, he and Coppola had strong personalities, but in a way, many of the things you say that Brando was wrestling with in his own internal struggle of good and evil and fate and free will and life and humanity and hypocrisies, I think it kind of all comes out there in those Kurtz rants. I really do.
Yeah, and I think he wanted to almost alert the audience to, make them, investigate the nature of evil. He was kind of sort of shining light on that, a topic that, we wouldn't really want to otherwise address. And so rather than the hero or the good guy, he would take on those roles quite purposefully because he wanted to make us confront those questions. It was something a bit didactic and teacher-like, lecturing about Brando, where he would want to make sure that we understood these things. There was a purpose in that, rather than just indulging his own negativity. He was trying to communicate, and things to the audience, for the audience to digest.
Yeah, it's a true exploration, absolutely. What did he have to, you know, compare that, you know, his, we've talked a lot about him and Coppola. How did he always view that working relationship compared to, say, he and Bertolucci on Tango?
I think it was a different dynamic, as you'd expect. I mean, I think Brando appreciated the artist and the competent artist, mm-hmm. you know, somebody who could, you know, justify their vision and explain things and talk them through. He liked guidance, in fact, and he appreciated right. that. You know, it's a very lonely job being a leading man
yeah.
and going out there, and, you know, you need, you know, he really appreciated having someone to bounce off, but that was all too rare. And with Bertolucci, I think that, you know, it was a slightly vulnerable time in his life. Mm-hmm. There was certain, you know, I got the feeling he was a little bit more fragile in the background around the shooting of Last Tango 2, and maybe a bit more susceptible to someone like Bertolucci, who was, you know, incredibly persuasive and you know, attentive to the actor, and would you know, just get down to their level and really try to communicate. And Bertolucci wanted to draw this personal history out of Marlon, and wanted Marlon to be, you know, as much of himself on screen.
Yeah.
Which Marlon always never wanted to do, and always say he'd resist it. But I think he also saw the appeal, because he was seeking truth on. He wanted to communicate truth.
Right.
And what better way to actually, you know, reveal social truths and personal truths to the audience than actually to reveal your own soul. And I'm pretty convinced that, you know, Bertolucci managed to, you know, draw that out of him. And I don't know whether it was something that Brando was, you know, necessarily proud of when he'd seen the final cut again. He didn't think it was, you know, something that maybe he had given too much. And I think he put up a few smoke screens saying that wasn't really him and what have you. But he was, I think he, you know, he was in that dialogue with Bertolucci. You know, he went to places where he never thought, or he never planned to go, and wanted to go.
Now, pivoting from Bertolucci to Pontecorvo, I mean, you mentioned that Burn, 1969 film, was Brando's personal favorite, and I'm sure it's one that a lot of our listeners probably haven't seen, at least compared to a lot of the other, you know, more famous movies we've mentioned. But Pontecorvo, man, I mean, he made Battle of Algiers a few years before that, I think 66 maybe, and man, that movie is just an all-time masterpiece. And then here in Burn, he works with Brando. So why in your documentary does Brando, you know, what does he say about Burn, and why does he hold that up as his own personal favorite accomplishment?
I've got to be honest. So actually, Burn's not, and you see this clips of it again, but I don't go into the story of Burn in the documentary.
Okay.
But I know in terms of why Brando would have chosen that role.
Okay.
You know, it just offered so much more besides. You know, it's a commentary on colonialism and greed and this quite sordid diplomacy and realpolitik that, you know, that would mean maneuvering to further themselves and reward, you know, get what they want at the expense of others. Just the sort of thing that Marlon was interested in again.
Yeah.
He would, you know, that toying with these themes of the good and evil within us all, and what motivates us towards evil, was why he would have, you know, gone with that pick. I'm sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if people are so shocked, he sends, you know, the Native American statement thing at the Oscars. But really, if you look a couple years earlier at Burn, it's not hard to see why he would sympathize with that sort of a cause. I mean, Burn is about, you know, British colonialism in the sugar trade going down to the Caribbean, you know, so and kind of taking over down there. So, I mean, it's a very similar themes here of colonizing and what happens to the indigenous people, sort of a thing he's wrestling with. And it sounds like he had an affinity for Be My Brother's Keeper. I mean, at least according to you, that this is a fascinating topic.
Well, he got upset because, you know, Burn didn't really hit anyone's radar. It wasn't well marketed. It didn't go anywhere. And that would that was the sort of thing which left him really disillusioned. You know, he quoted the Hollywood saying that, you know, if you've got a message, go to Western Union. And he felt that right. actually any of, you know, message films didn't right. really attract the bucks right. and the marketing bucks.
Whereas
that I think was a source of disappointment to him.
Where, yeah, it had to be frustrating because then he turned around and, you know, do something like Superman and it reaches everybody, but, you know, not as much of a message in there. So that had to be been a frustrating thing he wrestled with back and forth throughout.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, so he calls, you know, he says Superman, even, you know, I'd love Superman as a kid, but, you know, Brandon said it was a rather silly movie.
Right.
He just got involved in it because it was paid him millions for a few days' work.
Sure.
And that was when, you know, that was, those describe some of the low points for him, you know, when he just wanted to, you know, take his money and run.
Right.
And clock in, and, you know, those were just paydays for him. And he didn't really work for much of the 80s after Superman.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of, you know, nice paid leave for him for best part of a decade.
Exactly. Is that why, as it kind of went into the 80s, did he sort of see the industry shifting sort of more down that route? I mean, we saw kind of an explosion of sequels and, you know, all kinds of, you know, sort of blockbuster culture really kind of took over in that decade. Was there less of a place for a curious social mind like Brando as we kind of forged ahead into the 80s and 90s?
I wonder. I'm trying to think of his roles. I mean, he actually got an Oscar. He got... you might have
a nomination.
This, I think he actually won a Best Supporting Actor for
right.
in 1989.
Dry White Season,
which was a very political film, and mm-hmm. as much as it dealt with apartheid in South Africa.
Yeah.
And you know, again, there he's playing a South African. He's been, you know, showing his range. And I know from speaking to the director of that film that. Before he went out on set, he would look at photos of the Soweto massacre where the school children were shot upon by the South African police. But in order to really, you know, almost kind of hurt himself and as sensitive as he was, and bring out that emotion so that he can give the best performance possible.
Absolutely. Well, see, and that's the thing. There were still movies like that being made, and there are today. They're the great ones. You kind of have to, you know, wade through the culture that the Superman spawned, which we are currently living in now, tons of superhero movies. But there's still movies like those very, you know, deep social movies like A Dry White Season that are still being done. So, I mean, he was with Donald Sutherland in that too, right? Wow, man. Yeah, I mean, just looking back at the body of work and all those directors he worked with, Pontecorvo, Bertolucci, Coppola, Kazan, who is Guys and Dolls? Was that Mankiewicz, I think? Yeah, Joseph Mankiewicz of All mm-hmm. About Eve. Man, I mean, the guy, it's probably no secret that great filmmaking artists are attracted to great acting artists. I mean, that can't be a coincidence there. Let's move into you know, we could sit here and talk about this forever, and you're like, well, we have. you know, let's move into the final chapter of his life, you know, sort of, you know, act three that you talked about of the three stages of Brando here in the movie. How it kind of ended up with this tragedy that unfolded in his home where, you know, his son literally, you know, commits murder, the murder of brother-in-law?
I think he was convicted for manslaughter in the end.
Manslaughter.
And it was his sister's boyfriend, actually the father of his sister's child. She was pregnant at the time.
Man. It was his sister's child?
No, so Cheyenne is with the name of his sister, and she was pregnant at the time.
Oh, I got you.
The son of the her boyfriend, who was shot by Christian.
Wow. Did they how much of your movie do you go into that? Let's say, just for comparison's sake, you know, last week one of the movies I reviewed was the Amy Winehouse doc, and you kind of, your whole movie, you're kind of wincing because you know it's going to be hard to watch in the end. How did you deal with, you know, such a sensitive topic, wanting to be respectful to Brando, but at the same time, you need to, you know, you absolutely have to include this in the movie. How'd you kind of do that delicate dance for Act Three there?
I mean, it is and was tricky to somehow nutshell however something like that could ever have happened. You know, bearing in mind that, you know, Christian and I had lots of materials I had access to, you know, tapes that that recorded Christian, you know, I got to know him in a certain way through this body of audio that I could, you know, just try and understand what kind of a character he was, and everything suggested, you know, a nice boy and then a nice young man, and how could things have then gone so wrong? Yeah. So you know, it wasn't seeking to necessarily explain anything other than, you know, in certain situations, you know, good people can do terrible things.
Yeah.
And that was and there is sometimes a possible explanation behind that. You know, how do we how are our behaviors dictated, and how are how could our particular character type ever respond in such a way as to have done something so, you know, out of character and so violent. And the thing was, it's an exploration of dysfunctional behaviour that can go right back to the roots of our childhood. And and Marlon recognises that it was the same dysfunction that he might have faced, or he did face as a boy, that then very possibly was inherited by his own son.
Which is, as you say that, I get chills, because that's exactly what The Godfather is. You know, you work your whole life in pursuit of, you know, this higher, you know, better life for your son, and in the end, you're saying the son is plagued by the same problems he had. You know, the father becomes the son, as he said in Superman. But it's the theme in Godfather too. It's amazing how this life parallels. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, there are those. I mean, I do know what you're saying. It almost feels a bit too flippant to, you know, to compare it to, you know, one of his lead roles. But I mean, there was quite a few instances where, you know, coincidentally, life would be imitating art.
Yeah.
And you know, Marlon would bring so much of the things he was interested in into, as I mentioned, from his own life into his roles, that it was deeply ironic that something like this could have happened, because it's the sort of thing that Marlon's talking about and predicting for many years.
And
where does violence and rage come from?
Yeah,
it was certainly an emotion that he was trying to diagnose and attend to in himself.
Absolutely. Did he? Was there a reason he named him Christian? Was this a spiritual thing, or is there a reasoning behind that?
Gino had he had a very good friend called Christian Marcon, who I'm pretty convinced was the reason that he named Christian after him. He obviously played Fletcher Christian in Meeting on the Bounty, but I don't remember that.
Right, the old was it a Gable character originally?
The first movie was. Yeah.
Right.
That was Clark Gable playing the same role.
Yep. whose style you say he did not approve of? All right, cool. Well, I remember when that whole case came out with you know, his son, but I haven't really, you know, followed it since. Is he still serving time right now?
No, so he's passed away now. Yeah, Yeah, he served his time in prison, and then not long after, several years after, he ended up dying from pneumonia, I believe.
Oh wow!
But he'd always been afflicted by that with lung problems from an early age, and actually did, and as did Marlon. It's actually among the illnesses which Marlon had towards the end of his life. Pulmonary fibrosis was one of the things which. Which killed him.
How do you handle sort of the end of his life and the end of his story? You know, what's sort of the final clip of Brando's own, you know, Brando on Brando. You know, we kind of talked about the Rosebud analogy. You know, if he had a final word on his lips in let's say if it was a perfect, obviously you're making a documentary and you're not there when he has his final word, but what do you think that final word would be to sum up this life?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things he says, which is in the documentary, is he says, you know, when he dies, he wanted to have a microphone placed in his coffin so that he could say and tell everyone to do it differently.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
And that was it. I mean, I think he was just incredibly, you know, that's the one thing, that's the exciting thing, is that for somebody who I know was very insecure, mm-hmm. Who had the same, you know, worries and concerns that we all have, and the same issues of confidence and, yeah. and definite superiority, that he was actually brave in his profession. And then he went outside of his comfort zone. He used to talk about, you know, just go off the high board, you know, and take risks. And a lot of people take the safe route, and that's one thing that can't definitely not be taken for Brando.
Yeah, I mean is that something great that, I mean, you think people go to see this documentary? Let's say our listeners who are, you know, interested in one or two of his roles but don't know much about his personal life, you know, what are they going to walk away from the theater thinking of this life and how they're going to apply it to how they live?
Well, I hope they'll go in really knowing him, you know, and actually knowing better than they ever thought, because, you know, the documentary is entirely in Marlon's own voice. There's not another voice in the film, which is Brando talking for the full extent. And he's the one who is explaining himself and describing himself and all the things he was fascinated and interested in. You know, I think they'll discover a complete individual, you know, and someone who is very human and not in an ivory tower of fame, which he always was trying to dismantle through the course of his life. He couldn't stand, you know, being separate from the world. He was someone who was ordinarily very much out there. You know, he wanted to embrace life, and he was, you know, and observe and be the voyeur, and that was deprived from him. But even despite that, you know, there's a real sort of like understanding and humanity, and you know, somebody who I really enjoyed spending time with. I was in the company of him in making the film for, you know, the edit was 9 months, and I had him that entire time, just trying to, you know, piece this grand story of his life together. It's all in his own voice, so it's autobiographical in that sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, you probably feel like he's an old friend at this point. You've spent a lot of time with him. Congrats on, you know, on getting the movie out there and the success. I know you were nominated Grand Jury Prize at Sundance, right?
Yeah, that was the world premiere, which was great fun. It was a privilege to be there.
What was it like sitting there, you know, spending so much time on this, obviously putting it together and so much energy and effort, and finally be able to look up and see it on the screen at Sundance? What was that like?
It was, yeah, fantastic. It's always interesting, you know, to screen it in front of a big audience, and that was the first time. Mm-hmm. So you never quite know how that's going to go, and it was, but it was, you know, really positive. I think, you know, people found that they could, you know, could connect with the movie, and it was emotional in the right place. And when I say the right place, you yourself have seen that emotion, so that I could feel that from the audience too. But it was interesting. There was some, you know, some people would turn up which you wouldn't get at a normal screening. There was you know, James Franco came to one, and nice. Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. I think they're all curious about all things Brando. So that was a nice surprise at Sundance.
So you find that today's actors and filmmakers, you know, the people you mentioned showing up in that room to watch it, there's still a fascination with Brando. Sort of, is it because he was kind of the best of the best at his craft, and people just want to figure out what made him tick? Or, I mean, there's still that fascination in today's Hollywood with Brando?
I think all those things. Yeah, he was so and so ambivalent. You know, he would operate at the extremes and was somebody you couldn't put your finger on him. He was always a moving target. But I think in his entirety, As again, I hope the documentary shows, he was incredibly human and someone that he was you could relate to. And so it's that humanity which I think is attracting, which attracts people as well. I mean, that's a quality you can't ever communicate. But even it's interesting, even my mum, who's from Montenegro, she remembers watching Brando as a young man. I'd ask her, so what was it about him you remember? And she goes, you know, she could tell his spirit and his humanity, this guy. And that was, you know, being communicated with subtitles. So it's all, I think, and you know, going back to Blazer Streetcar and his early roles, I mean, you know, the guy was a, you know, obviously, you know, handsome, you know, in a way that guys can appreciate right. well enough. You know, we understand as well as women, because I mean, just you know, he was just. I think you could step out of those films today and be just as popular. I mean, he was setting an entire, you know, look and fashion which would pervade the entire 20th century, defined a lot of 20th century cool. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he was there from the get go. He was the originator and the revolutionary, and so for all these reasons, I think there will always be a fascination in him.
Absolutely. Well, hey, listen, Stephen, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us. I think we just passed the hour mark, but it felt like 10 minutes to me, man. I mean, it's fascinating stuff. So I think remind everybody, it's called Listen to Marlon. It comes out in our area in D.C. at the E Street Cinema on Friday, August 14th. What day does it go national? Do you know? Or is it limited release, or what's the deal with that?
No, it does go national, I think, throughout August. I should know this. Sorry, I know that there's it opens in New York, I think, on the 27th or 28th, one of those two. Mm-hmm. Then in LA on the 31st, and then I think it goes to plenty of other cities in the following week or so.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well,
early August. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing it. So everybody come out and see it at the E Street Cinema on August 14th. And that's Stephen Riley. Everybody, thanks so much for coming on. You don't know how much I appreciate it.
Pleasure.